Hey guys, welcome to the MC Anime Podcast.
We cover anime, geek culture, Japanese aesthetics, and Asian studies. We are a multi-fandom podcast, and you can expect to hear topics in your favorite hobby or fandom activity potentially. You can find MC Anime on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, please check out mcanimepodcast.com, our website. Furthermore, stay tuned in for another episode.
Welcome to another episode of MC Henry Podcast. MC here. We're back with Leah today. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been so far so good this week, and the weekend was great. So here we are for a history lesson. How are you?
Yeah, very interesting one. Interesting. I'm getting to adapt to the new schedule. Like my, you know, focus building on my repertoire of Asian studies and a little bit of history here and there. So let's go with it.
Okay.
So today's topic is going to be Asian studies, China and the world sphere. Basically, what we're going to do, we'll be analyzing four main events. And then at the end, if we have time, bring up some more events that has influenced the world or the perception of China during that time period and how each perception of the world towards China had changed through each event that we were mentioning.
Well, and this one is, since we do so much focus on more of the current cultural stuff that we talked about, and we do have our more like history and religion and culture, we did want to bring it back and do a kind of more detailed series on different Asian countries. And we'll be starting with China. We'll start with the biggest one in regards to landmass and all of that, and then we'll start to fan out from there. So,
Interesting perspective about China, because it has so much history. We actually chose to do the perception of how the world perceives China as a more like general overview of China's influence in the world at different periods of history.
Yep.
So the four periods of history of China is ancient China, imperial China, the Republic of China, and then the next period was the People's Republic of China. These are all distinct because of the type of government of what actually are occurring in those years building up to those different periods. And the actual four events that we're going to mainly discuss, and if we have time for more, we can do that at the end, will be the Age of Inventions, the British and Opium War, the End of the Empire, and the Communist Revolution. So before we get into it, what's your thoughts about the different periods of Chinese history and some of the topics that we'll be discussing, or the influence and perception of China during these times?
Well, honestly, I've never really looked at history from, the same view about each country regarding each other. So it's cool to learn about, different eras of Chinese history, because honestly I didn't know much when you wanted to do this topic, but it does show some variance in how over the years the evolution of Western perception when it came to Chinese culture, intelligence, learning styles, their government and how they ran their country, seeing how there were these stark differences, but because there were so many developments in China, while these differences were largely huge, the way that the Western world and the rest of the world engaged with China itself is much different than they did with other countries like India, Africa, South America, stuff like that. So when I think of how globalization came about, you do see how, because of China's accomplishments, a lot of things he didn't even think came from China, and their ability for trade and invention made the actual engagement between them and majority of the Western world that much more interesting. So, I mean, none of these eras I actually really focused on. I don't think they're taught really that much in schools here in America. You kind of get like a brief overview of China. So it was cool to kind of dive in.
Yeah. Funny enough, when I was looking at the different periods, I was like, well, these are some talking points. And I sounded like a teacher giving an overview. And then we discussed, it's a whole perception. It's like, okay, well, there's at least four different events because they all have different major impacts.
Yeah.
But yeah, the first one we're going to do is the Age of Inventions. Throughout ancient ancient China, they had a lot of discoveries. And through the mannerisms of ancient China, we came to things like fireworks, which was also the gunpowder, to invent, you know, paper making, the invention of the compass. They start printing. You know, we also have, you know, porcelain being a big factor later down the line in Imperial China. So the building of trade was a really big sector during this time period. And Asia was like in a control aspect in Asia for major trading. The Silk Road also came through as well.
Okay. The Silk Road is probably the most popular one that I think people know of, which was kind of like a, either just a trade road that was used that went from China, from their coastal city all the way through, I think, went all the way through Europe up to Turkey.
Yeah.
And, you know, with that, they were able to not only have changes in agriculture by the introduction of new fruits and vegetables, but also other things like silks and fabrics and even gunpowder and other tools. So I think the Silk Road is probably the only thing I knew about ancient China before this. And of course, like some of their dynasties.
Yeah, the rise of dynasties in China is really big. It's kind of interesting because, you know, a lot of like European history is with like monarchies, kings, such as that. But these people during the dynasties in China were like family generations of emperors and actually being the figurehead of the entire state. So they had a lot of influence and, you know, that
hey, right?
And all that stuff. Well, it's kind of similar to a king having an heir, but it's also like it was more state. It was less overturning the dynasty while a king had can be overturned at any moment.
I don't know. We did have an episode where we talked about the different dynasties that were taken over. And we had an episode where we showed that, yes, you can't take over dynasties in China or in these ancient countries. But I would say the main difference is that in Western or European countries, when it came to their rulers, you had the kings and they might rule over the nation. Or even like the entire country or whatever. But there was a separation most of the time with them in the church. They had the power of the church. While I think what we've learned, especially for Japan and their history, when it came to their rulers and their emperors and all of that, that's who was kind of regarded as like the direct line to God, rather than how we have like the Pope in European countries.
Well, you're just going to the mandate of heaven.
Yeah. So like, that's what we learned with Japan at least. Because when they lost the World War, that like them losing in the World War and submitting was because they were like, well, if our top guy says, yeah, we have nothing left, everyone just immediately kind of like gives up and falls. So I will say that's the only difference. That's it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how not only did China become the trading hub, but it also established that a ruler must have the approval of the gods. It was believed that like natural disasters, famines, and, you know, anything in space related was signals that the emperor and his dynasty were losing the mandate of heaven. So, you know, one devastating aspect when you look at history, you have absolute monarchy, but you also have the mandate of heaven for a very long time in China. So two different belief systems, but kind of similar in how you look at it, being given power by God. Instead of China, you're chosen by God. Well, I think European, you're giving powers from God.
You get the blessing from God. Like, well, you get the blessing from like the Pope or the church or whatever that goes to the king. Yeah, that's the difference. But as you were saying, though, when it came to like the Silk Road, for one, it was 4,000 miles, which is insane. it spanned an entire continent. But what I learned was, in regards to ancient China, they got their name because silk was the only thing that came that was made in China. You couldn't find it anywhere else, which was one of their first inventions that really caught the eye of other trading countries. And this was during the Han Dynasty. So they made it using silkworms and raising them. And what they would do is that they would make the silk, they would dye it, they would weave it together. And also they had a penalty of death if you told anyone how this process was done. So that way it was exclusively within, you know, ancient China during that time within the Han Dynasty rule.
Yeah.
Which I found to be really cool.
Yeah, because the Han Dynasty was very strong in not only its applications, but its firm and strict guidelines to rule the nation that it did. So a lot of Chinese people look at the Han Dynasty as a very strong, endeavoring part of China's history. So it's kind of interesting to see how influenced to this day that the Han Dynasty actually had in China. Reinforcing policy, reinforcing trade. Basically, well, China had a monopoly in the trade system itself because the Silk Road was like one of the few routes to connect with the global market at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyone, if you like enjoy fiction, especially if you like Pirates of the Caribbean, you know about the West India Trading Company. And a big push for that was because of the Silk Road and the monopoly that China had when it came to trading. So them trying to find other ways to get to other ports without having to take the land road, and then of course there's Athaton, there's all of that stuff, and it was tedious and it was very, very hard to get through it. But not just legislation and stuff and trade road that the Han Dynasty have. They also were very big on pushing for education and learning as well as the arts during that time, which is why China flourished in which it did, and it actually became kind of one of the most influential countries during this time, because they had basically advanced themselves by putting so much effort into learning about agriculture, making new technologies, medicines, and all of that, because the Han Dynasty and their leadership really like dug that in. That was a big pushing point for their work.
It's kind of interesting because when you look at it, the educational system flourishing, being as like, you know, way to get access to it was very big at the time, but also most people were farmers, so very few people could actually afford the education, so the commoner actually had to pay for it. So the elite were most the ones having access to the education at the time during ancient China, where it actually worked.
Very true, but I do think that they had more of a trickle down when it came to advancements, because if you are an agriculture country and that's a big part of your trade, you can't just teach the rich who probably aren't going outside how to do all the farming stuff. So they made the things like they made the iron plow, they made rudders for steering ships, they made a seismoscope to detect when earthquakes were coming, they had the compass, and also they created the wheelbarrow, which I guess never once in my life did I think about how the wheelbarrow came to be, but it came from the Han Dynasty. So, and the compass, which is very important because people probably just had to trust the word of the traveler, and you had to know the lay of the land. So I think that these advancements that were made by the more educated and rich and more influential, it was very fortunate that they made sure that it went back to the people, so that way they could have like this stronghold when it came to trade, and people having to be reliant on them and the Silk Road to get their goods across, and also, you know, yeah, Mongolians just acting up. But yeah, China, the Silk Road, they did a bunch of other stuff too though.
Oh yeah, you know, that's a lot to cover with the different dynasties and the different ancient China and the Mel, and also the Mesolithic period in the Silk Road. But when you really look at it, the trading empire that China establishes is the major perception of China during this time period, during this era, I should say, during this like 18th century. There's a long expanding time frame where China limited they had these big influence of how the trade worked and actually be able to be successful because of the fact that they're large, but also have the expansive goods to be able to trade with in the first place. And having, you know, one of the few routes being vital to access to the global market being a big influence in how they do it.
Absolutely.
That you want to say about the age of invention and discovery in ancient China?
The only last like little note that I would like to grab also is that, because again, the Han Dynasty was so influential, one thing that was also important with how they went about doing their age of invention, which I think is a big stark difference to what we saw with America and a lot of European countries, is that they definitely encouraged the teachings and learnings of Confucianism in Chinese art and scholarship, because normally as you start to advance in society, that's always a big fear, is that you start to pull away from tradition. So in China with the Han Dynasty, as they made the same rate that they made these advancements, for the same rate that they were making sure that traditional Chinese culture stayed alive and well, so that way they still kept their spirit, they still kept who they were as a people alive and well, as they made these advancements and made life a little bit easier for themselves, which is very hard to do when you start to get convenience in your life. Well, as much convenience as you can have during those really hard times. But yeah.
But yeah, other notable parts of ancient China, there was a Bronze Age during the period. There was also different versions of the dynasties coming in, the Mongol invasion, you know, the formation of the early parts of the Great Wall of China was being established. You know, took about a lot of centuries to build, but the earlier versions started to happen. But with that being said, ancient China during this time with the Age of Invention is pretty strong and pretty dominant in the trading sector.
Okay.
And having a huge influence. So that's how that was perceived.
Yes. Oh, and I feel like it's weird if we don't mention it. They made paper.
They did printing.
So a lot of things that, because beforehand they used to write on silk, they used to write on bone, they used to write on wood, and that's how they kind of would keep records of things, which is naturally, I've never tried to write on silk, but nowadays we try to keep things off of it. So the idea that they did basically give the world a way to document and transcribe history in a way that wasn't just chiseling into stone or cave paintings or writing on silk is absolutely fascinating, because they did something that allowed human history to live on in a much more, I don't know, transferable way than it being a stone tablet. Like, we've moved from Moses now on to like Shakespearean. So I'm like, I thought that was a really cool thing to learn from the Chinese, from ancient China.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Paper making was definitely big, but also the printing. They also established printing as a way to not only make paper making more available, but the literature and the art aspect is really how they're expressing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, other parts of the world, like Egypt with papyrus and Mesopotamia with clay. But, you know, there is not much like large scale paper production in those areas. So China has a more influence in how they did it. So just look at that as a testament to China. But yeah,
the
thing is we're going to cover is a part of Imperial China. This is towards like the Indo part of Imperial China, British and the Opium Wars. Kind of interesting how the one trading empire came to be weakened on the global market.
So when it comes to Imperial China, that went from 2021 BC up into 1912 AD. And, you know, this is the time that was ruled by emperors. They had a changing of the imperial dynasty and the royal family. And there was a lot of fighting when it came from invasions, especially by the Mongols. So for those who don't know what the Opium War is or was, so there was actually two of them. And they were fought during the mid-19th century between China and Western countries and Western forces. And they're the Qin Dynasty? No, that's wrong.
Yeah.
I was like, no, I said that wrong. So the first one that started in 1832 to 1842 was fought between China, Great Britain. And then the second one was from 1856 to the 60s, and it was also known as the Arrow Wars. And they fought with Great Britain and France. And these wars basically existed because British traders were bringing in large amounts of opium, and this was causing widespread addiction across China and weakening the country overall. So they went from kind of moving forward and having a monopoly almost in the world trade as the world was for a hot minute. And then once they got to 2021 BC and entered out of the ancient China into imperial, the British found a way to basically weaken them, to stun their intelligence, their growth, their inventions, all of that. And just so you know, when it comes to opium, if you don't know what it is, highly addictive drug, like a reddish brown, and it comes from the juice of an opium poppy, and it can be used as medicine, but for the most part, it does just act as like a heavily addictive drug that's normally makes you feel good, it makes you feel very happy, and it can also be used to make stuff like heroin. So
yeah,
yep.
But yeah, and the previous to the opium wars, the perspective of China was they were allowing certain ports for certain countries to come in, and you could only trade at that port. They wanted to expand into China more. China halted the process, so you could only trade here and here. So only certain countries had access to certain ports. So the introduction of opium was an inadvertent way to actually cripple the global monopoly that China was having. So basically opening up the borders to trade was how opium influenced the people of China. Not only did the British introduce the opium into the country, and other countries also seized the opportunity as well, they would take the opium, congest it, and then after congesting the opium, they start wanting more. And that demand for the addictive drugs start impacting more and more people. And as a result, it's this cascading effect in the actual political atmosphere at the time and the economy. And the wars were really detrimental in China losing to actually open up the borders and allow more trade than previously centuries before.
I would touch on the fact though, when you do kind of learn about the opium war, it is almost identical to how, but not in the way that it started or anything like that, but the same way where Japan had their isolationist like period where they just wanted to be purely focused, right? Japanese, they did very little trade outside of their country, and then the U.S. came and basically forced them, like showed up with an army and forced them to open up and do trade with the rest of the world. You kind of get that feeling when you learn about the opium wars. So because it started with the British wanting to have more trading ports and expansion within their trade, and also bringing in these drugs, as China tried to push back and confiscate and take all of these drugs without their country in like 1839. They confiscated and destroyed more than 20,000 chests of opium, which was around 1,400 tons that were in a warehouse held by British merchants. And as time kept going, there were attacks from British soldiers that ended up killing a Chinese merchant. The British decided not to actually let the soldiers be tried. The sailors be tried there in China because they were like, man, y'all kind of tough over there. So they just didn't let them be extradited back to China. Instead, they just held on to them. And as time kept going on, British warships would attack blockades that were in Pearl River. They would hit places like Hong Kong. And then eventually, they went up against the Qing dynasty, their forces. No, I'm saying the name wrong. But they were able to beat them. And even with the reinforcements from the Chinese troops, by the spring of like 1842, they had won over that area. They had captured Nanjing, which I believe is like a city. And so from there, peace treaty had to come up, and it gave the British so much stuff. Like it gave them, it gave them Hong Kong Island. They had the Chinese had to pay Britain. They had to pay them money for Britain coming in and just acting British, just being belligerent. They also got to increase the number of their treaty ports, and they went from having one to having five. And then they had four more designated ports that were in Shanghai, and that also gave access to foreigners to like begin doing a transformation within the city. So that way it became a very big commercial like spot. It became a commercial port. And then they also signed in something that was called the Treaty of Fog, which meant that if they committed crime, they weren't tried in China for the crimes that they committed there as British citizens. They would go back to Britain and be tried there, which naturally makes it very annoying. And but these rights were then expanded out to other Western countries, so that way they would have these same benefits as well. So that was the first Opium War, which just
And the cost of the Opium Wars, basically, you know, you have unequal treaties between China and foreign imperial powers, Great Britain, France, United States, Russia, Japan, whatever. You know, they were forced to concede their territorial sovereignty rights, and basically the sovereignty of China ruling as the Qing dynasty weakened and only toppled the dynasty, beginning with a revolution. Then after the collapse of the Opium Wars and stuff like that. So the really long-term impact was not only the weakening of the borders, global trade being expanded, no monopoly anymore as before in the ancient China, but also interesting applications to China, I guess what, traditional implications as well.
It's very tough to read through it and see kind of how they really did find, they found a, what was a reasonable thing for China to push back on, which was a major drug trade and drug problem within their country. And their efforts to preserve their country and their people only led to them losing so much more than I think that they thought was even possible. Also losing Hong Kong Island, like, I didn't know that was even a thing that had happened or could happen.
That's why Hong Kong was given back to China in the 1900s. It was 1970, 1980, something like that. I mean, it was a pretty long time before it was given back.
Yeah, they kept it for a while, which is normally how it goes. I mean, they do the same. Like, they've done the same, but it doesn't change the fact that the start of it and how the Opium Wars ended, and it kind of knocking China from having a dynasty rule to having a Republican government because of it, is a very big and significant change. It's a huge difference than what we saw with the Han Dynasty.
You know, British was also a nation of tea drinkers. The band for China's tea rose astronomically. Also, another thing was the silk and the trading routes, cotton and all that stuff, were heavily influenced with China. So them pushing back with opium to weaken the country, they knew what they were doing because they knew there was previous efforts of addiction in that community. They didn't care. You know, the foreign encroachment policy in the Opium War was enormous in its effect, and basically trying to open the floodgates.
And it's great for trade, but very oppressive in so many other ways.
Yes.
Wow.
You know, this brings, you know, the next topic, the end of the empire. I mean, after the Opium War, the Qing dynasty very had a hard time keeping up. They lost with the Qing watch, and it really just proved that, you know, maybe dynasty was not the way to rule the people of China anymore.
Well, yeah. If you guys think back to what was said in the portrait for ancient China, with the Han Dynasty, they had a big push for the conservation of Chinese principles and traditionalism, teaching Confucianism. But because of this, that meant that they were very unchanging in the way that they did things. They were, the Confucius principles, they didn't value change or progress. It was more about stability, harmony, peacefulness, under the rulers who had the mandate of heaven. So these are the emperors that they have. And because they had so much interference coming from Western countries and also from Japan, it felt as though even though they had that privilege of the mandate of heaven, this top class of individuals who they were supposed to put their lives into and follow whatever they said as goes, they were winning. The drug trade had, the opium crisis had like crippled the country. The opium wars had made them lose so much. So yeah, by the 19th century, 1911, 1912, they were turned into a republic forcefully.
The Opium Wars singled many more wars to come. The extraterritoriality, treaty ports, all of that was a big hit. But the other big hits were like the Tablet Rebellion, the Dan Revolt. You also have the Tanzhu Restoration. We also have the Self-Strengthening Movement, the First Sino-Japanese War, the concession of Taiwan to Japan, they just could not keep up. Their army during this time, you know, was emerging a pattern of basically everyone stomping over them. And the Qing dynasty, unfortunately, was probably the last dynasty because of, you know, they tried to do the self-strengthening movement and the denied such efforts. They really weren't actually reaffirming to Western ideas. So in that process and establish weakness in policy and the unwillingness to adapt to change. Same thing with Japan, but in a different way. They had a detrimental impact of not being together, and all the theories of war after the Opium Wars pretty much crippled the country even more, which led to the change of government to the Republic of China and actually bind themselves in that stronghold before we know what China is today.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, also, Empress Darius Seki had been a dominant voice in the Avenue government, but she also was just using power that she didn't have, buying a two-ton boat, you know, a marvel boat, just extravagant things happening as a result that didn't look really favorable in the actual public view of the leader of China. And I think Empress Su, she was made to power being a puppet monarch. So that's how she gained power. And she didn't really help the dynasty at all. She made it worse. Because you're the one refusing to actually adapt to the change and not actually accordingly carry out change necessary for China during this time.
Yeah, and I think she also, basically kind of forfeiting and making concessions before she actually passed away in 1908. So just a few years before the Qing dynasty turned into a republic, like the Republic for China. She basically just said, y'all could have it, and it gave up before her death, which is very disheartening as a ruler to think that she just said whatever, like it is what it is. Successor was someone young anyway who was following her, so they weren't going to have much choice within what was going to happen next anyway.
Yeah, and also the Boxer Rebellion didn't help either, so it just made it even worse. So there were a lot of conflicts during this time, and the refusal to change or doing some change but not doing all the necessary changes really weakened the power of what China had at the time.
Yeah, I do also think it's interesting that the teams like who were currently ruling at that time, but there were a few things that did stand out. So naturally you had the external forces, and mind you, this is a dynasty that had been ruling China for 268 years before it collapsed in 1911, like 1912. But a big part of it, like, was because they considered themselves to be outsiders and not, like, truly of the Chinese people, because they were, Manchurian.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why anything would say that. That sounds like such a terrible position to make when you're ruling over people, is to tell them, like, we have a mandate of heaven, but we're not like y'all. We're not like you unmandated peasants. Which is just, of course people are going to turn against you, and then with the wars and lack of leadership, of course they're going to fall apart. But for 268 years, it almost was like anticlimactic, because you would think it would be like a bigger, like there would be more and more rebellions and probably a big war, kind of what we saw in Japan, when there would be these overturns of power, but it wasn't multiple parties like assassinating each other left and right. It just kind of seemed like, down to see towards the end of that, to be lazy, and just very unmotivated. They just kind of gave up.
Yeah, and also with the, you know, wrapping out the Manchu influence, you know, you have efforts of people blocking at court, alienated reformers, you know, quote unquote Manchu restoration, but that really didn't really gain any ground. So basically, after the previous dynasty was, you know, weeded out, it really became now, under the new power struggle, how the Republic of China would actually be ran. And this wasn't really a peaceful transition of power. It was basically anyone who can grab it with the most influence
this is what military kind of like established the power more now.
Well, yeah. I mean, that wasn't appointed ruler. He's president of the Republic. He just wasn't prepared for the military influence and political influence that he got from his opponent. I think they thought, like, no, now that we don't have an emperor or empress, we can just assign a president and people can kind of like pass their vote and we do it that way. But it wasn't like that at all. It wasn't.
Yeah, but yeah. It's the combination of things that the Queen Dynasty could not keep up with, the Marju influence further isolated them in the political atmosphere. The wars continued to drain the actual progress of China during this time. It was very influential. China, with the end of the empire, is maybe even more weakened than the Opium Wars. They were adapting totally, scrapping the old form of government, going with a new form of government. And this is not the only Asian country doing this during the time. You know, Japan was also of a similar change. Shoot, they were beating China in an earlier war. So really, it's just going to show you that the power shift in Asia switched.
And we won't take it as that the Republic of China was this, just because it flipped over and that was supposed to regain some vigor for the country. Unfortunately, it didn't last that long to begin with, and then also they had a lot of turmoil throughout it, because again, the old empress, when before she died and decided that they would go ahead and become a republic, her successor was a 6-year-old, and because he had to go up against, there was a man called Sun Yat-sen, and he, I'm sorry, Sun Yat-sen was he became the president of the republic. He was a 6-year-old, but he had to go up against a like this military opponent and high-ranking kind of political figure called Yuan Shikai. And Yuan, he already had a career in the military. He was self-confident. He was ambitious. He was older. And he was able to rise to high powers and positions. And so he was able to command the military force and almost started a civil war. So the now president of the country basically had an almost warlord that he was going to go head-to-head with, and had to stop a civil war from popping off and happening. They made a deal. Even as time kept going on, unfortunately, like Yuan, the military guy, at one point he just declared himself emperor in like 1915. He made his own like little area and decided he was going to make himself emperor. It did, of course, fall apart in like a year. He didn't last that long doing that. And yeah, they still had a president, but it was so much fractured power and energy and influence that it was very, very hard for it to actually be anything. They were just tired of the dynasty flowing.
Pretty much. The mandate of heaven was no longer applicable to policy. It was more like people were more involved in the republic. I mean, it was still a mess, but it was a step in the right direction to establish the government in modern times. So really, it was necessary to have that turmoil to actually figure out what they're actually going to do, how they're going to love in the country. Now, is the new model better? It's okay. It does what it needs to. It's efficient in giving just enough to reinforce in the policies and government.
Yes, I would say that it did a great job of allowing an actual, like a visual representation that other people can be in power, and you are able to grab power with enough influence. It is not, no matter how high up in the chain you go up to, there'll always be this dynasty family that was completely separated from everyone. It wasn't a caste system. It was like there was a caste system, and then at the very top, there was a completely empty space, and above that was the dynasty. So the Republic of China, it only made it until 1949 before it was officially dissolved. And then we went into the People's Republic of China. But you do have to have a messy period in order to truly see what worked and what doesn't. And luckily, they still kept up a republic system rather than going back to dynasties in one ruling family. But it was a little messy.
Yeah.
And I think other countries saw that as well. But everyone goes through that.
Yeah. It's a sort of transition period of new power and establishing new power to see if that new power can actually hold for more than like that 50-year period. So But yeah, with the introduction of the People's Republic of China, we also had the Chinese Communist Revolution. So, you know, during this time, after World War II, the spread of communism became the new policymaker. And communism is a form of ideological beliefs that, you know, everyone gets a fair proportion of the job salary, the income, whatever the resources being delegated from the government. The government has the ruling and how it dictates it, it's like a very low, it's very high impact, but it's very military driven, and a lot of clashing were happening with capitalism and communism during the split of the Cold War. So with Chinese during the Communist Revolution becoming the Chinese War of Liberation, or, you know, the People's Republic of China, it's a national war against the Communist Rebellion, in which, you know, the Republic of China versus the People's Republic was kind of like that clash into the new government age for China.
Mm-hmm.
And the problems with Western imperialism and the decline of the Qing Dynasty, it kind of like made the Chinese Communist Party to be formed in the early versions of 1921 and eventually gain power in 1949.
Yeah. So once there was the fall, and mind you, the CCP or the Chinese Communist Party, this was considered a peasant party, and it had learned its techniques within the countryside, but had adopted Marxist ideology, and they believed that, you know, it was a class struggle, and they also believed that there was a development and a rapid growth in the industrial development happening within the country. But yes, they absolutely believed that there needed to be one form of thought, one way to operate the country, one people, one everything. And because there had been so much chaos that has started, one from the Opium Wars, where mentally and spiritually people were weaker, because the country had been attacked so heavily, and then they had lost so much, and then having to change from the dynasty to the republic failing, and then you have this Communist Party that comes in that really did focus, kind of, it brought people together, and it came from the countryside, where that's where it all began, and that's how China began to grow its influence with the trade, was from the countryside, was from farmers. So it had a lot of appeal from the very beginning. I think it was the first political party to pop up that felt more of the people, which is why it's called the People's Republic, than anything else that they probably had in maybe the last, 75 years, maybe 100 years, from going from the Qing Dynasty into their last republic. And now they actually have a People's Republic that they probably feel reflects their voices and wants more than what they were getting beforehand. And it probably also felt less chaotic. But it did create an absolute different perspective to the outside world of probably what they thought of China beforehand.
Yeah. And another thing with the People's Republic of China that's kind of interesting, it also adapts similar policies the dynasties had, in a way in which the power trickled down through the government, and the government being such a tool to be used by the public. This resonates more because now not only you have an ideological base to raise your petition and assemble and actually gather numbers, but you can also find a similar pattern within dynasty in the actual invocation that we are for you and without the mandate of heaven, but we're still going to be very influential in your life, and there's certain things that we're going to give you that you don't have to do necessarily yourself. So that application is why the People's Republic of China is so influential in the world sphere, even though the Cold War is really messy in political struggle. I feel like the People's Republic of China is what people of China needed to actually take over, sustain themselves from the chaos of the wars before it, and actually became something more. The industrialization method, the waking out the weak points that other countries have already done, but continuing that advancement in a way that's, going back on the world stage eventually. This is the movement in where China was able to, over 50 years, 100 years, to rebuild itself from where it lost and how it how it is today.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the biggest thing is that this was a materialized, like, version of the wins that they had from the ruling class, like the people, those who were possibly kind of going along with what was being told by these dynasty and the failed president of the last republic, and then, you know, the guy who decided he was going to also become an emperor. This was like that of the peasants winning over, like, these urban cities and these people who were moving so fast with their developments and changes and dealing with trade and war that the people who existed felt like they had no voice. And now came the Chinese Communist Party that was basically creating their own symbolism for them and for their wins. But because of this, they also realized, like the party leaders of the CCP, they learned that, hey, we have no idea how to truly transition our nation into socialism and how to focus on industrialism. Clearly, we didn't know what we were doing in the past. Who can we turn to? And that's when they turn to the Soviet Union, which, because of past tensions with other Western countries and Russia, them seeing, one, China, a country that they had in a way neutered with the Opium Wars and that causing internal struggles and kind of the breakdown of their government and their unity, seeing them rebuild themselves back up, but going towards communism and socialism and stuff like that was not well reciprocated at all. They saw that as a threat and a problem. And of course, there was the Korean War, which they kind of contributed in, and that still only worsened relations between China and the other Western countries. But yeah, they knew that to have this communist political system, they were going to raise China up to a great power. They did the chairman at the time, Chairman Mao, he saw it as a revolutionary vision. That is what he preached. So he would tell people that we're going to turn our cities into consumer cities and producer cities. We're going to have like four different coalition classes, and there'll be one for like the poor and the farmers, who will be like the petty, like bourgeoisie. I can't say that word. Whatever. And then the national one. But essentially, he was saying that all of us will be equal. And it's also giving a term that makes people feel very fancy and like sophisticated. Even if they were poor and even if they were in rural areas, they were part of the bourgeoisie. Ooh, got it. They also said, we're just going to be a dictatorship. That was the big thing. It's the Republic of the People, but because it's communism, it's technically a dictatorship. So you have this one ruling party, and they were just going to make sure that any other political groups, any other voices that might cause change, they were going to oppress those, so that way the country can stay focused. And that's when there was a major shift.
It's not really a dictator, it's more of an authoritarian one-party system. People have a say in who gets elected, but it's only a one-party system, so the variety of candidates are in the same party. So, yeah. But being an authoritarian one-party system has its advantages and disadvantages. However, I think it might be the way it works. It works just enough to skate by that it has an impact as a republic that is not totally dictatorship. So, it's low on the totem pole. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. I don't know what dropped out. Anyway, all right. Well,
you know,
I was saying that when it comes to the People's Republic / dictatorship buildup, because the Communist Party in play only allows certain candidates to go up for roles or for elections or even a presidency, it still has the republic structure. But because they've made it very clear that they are the ones choosing who the candidates are, because they are, you know, voices is best for the people, they know best, it still has a dictatorship formula to it. The people do get to vote, but they are aware that they're not getting to vote for just anybody, and not just anybody who can raise money to get a platform and to, you know, put themselves before the people, have a chance. It is legitimately, you have to be approved by the CCP, and you have to be a part of the CCP. There's no way around it.
Yeah, that is the one-party system. The allegiance to the one-party system and the one-party system guiding the next generation of candidates in the presidency. So,
yes.
I mean, there is an aspect of control, but it is the system that China uses that they adopted. So, in retrospect, it's just their form of government. There's not much way around it.
No, it is their form of government, but it's still a form of dictatorship. Like, that, everyone could agree on that one. It's not a pretty word, but it is. Especially if they're modeling it off of the Soviet Union. Like, at a certain point, fade of a fade, even if you put it in a different jacket. It is what it is, but we can move on.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the different influences of major events influencing China and the world's perception of China during each, basically, event. Is there anything else you want to, like, mention as an honorable mention?
I would say for people to look into not only how China has traded with Western countries, but also other Asian countries and its impact on them. Again, they've had such a big influence in the agricultural growth, the technology growth that we see still to this day around the world. That the fact they were able to do that and then go through all of these kind of almost pitfalls as they've redeveloped and redesigned, like, what their country is and how it's run is very impressive. And even to this day, they're still making huge technological strides, and they really do have a very smart group of people, regardless of even what's happened with recent times. They're very intelligent countries. So seeing how they interact with others is very fascinating. So I'm actually happy that we did this episode, because I never actually looked into it. I just knew, you know, this China, I always knew they were very smart, and I thought it was more so just with technology, but seeing their starting point till now, just shows you how impressive their people are in the work that they do.
Yes. And another application of China, the taking the world's perspective, is the numbers game. Not only do they have access to a very grand populace that can be into the labor market, they establish not only the economy, but it establishes them as a global power in the economy itself and having major influence in how international affairs and foreign policy is done. And, you know, less than about, you know, approaches into certain, political spheres, but in the actual scheme of things, they are a major world contender, just like they were back in ancient China. But now, with how the world is working, maybe even have an even grander influence on the world than previously ever thought they could have. So I say commends, and they're here to stay.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. This concludes this episode of Asian Studies of China and the world's sphere and how people perceive them and their influence in the events we mentioned, like, you know, the applications in the Opium Wars, the Age of Invention, the end of the empire, and the Communist Revolution to reform China to where it is today. Hope you guys take something out of it and adapt your version of how you perceive China. And let it be a testament to the history of China, and then make your perception. Then you might open your eyes to things previously not mentioned, like Leah has mentioned before.
Yep, we'll have more episodes like this for other Asian countries, so keep an eye out for that.
Yep, thank you for being here, and it was nice having this conversation with you.
Mm-hmm, as always.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
This concludes another episode of MC Anime Podcast. MC Anime Podcast is available on podcast directories like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. We also have our website at mcanimepodcast.com. If you want to directly support us, then follow Patreon blog MC Anime. Finally, if you want services for hire, then we're available on Fiverr for audio and video production, graphic design, idea consulting, and blog and article writing.